Thanks to Bill Hartung, author of Prophets of War, for being with us for the first 2 hours talking about Lockheed Martin and the making of the military-industrial complex. Interesting guy. We're switching gears now to something quite different. Why do we believe what we believe, whether it's political beliefs, religious beliefs, moral beliefs? What is it about faith that that sort of takes control of our lives? Some of you are going to be upset by what this guest is going to tell us. He's the author of a new book called To Believe or Not to Believe. His name is Rahashia Poe, and he joins us in just a minute, and it's going to be some controversial stuff. Hope you're staying up with us tonight. It should be good stuff here on Coast to Coast AM. Rahashia Poe has written this new book, To Believe or Not to Believe, and I can tell you right now, some of you are not going to like it. You're not going to like the, you're going to find the basic premise to be a challenge to your beliefs, to your faiths. You may take umbrage with him, but we're going to listen to him for a while, hear what he has to say, and then open up the phone lines a little bit later, and you can ask your questions as well. Rahashia, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
You know what you're in for, I guess. You probably get some pretty strong reactions wherever you go and deliver this message.
Yeah, whenever you're talking about people's beliefs, whatever those beliefs might be that we identify with, you're always walking on some pretty touchy ground. But like they say, the truth is a blasphemy when first spoken. And time and history has shown us that it's always been that way, and it probably always will be, at least for a while.
I guess we should start with this, is that your book is not meant to supplant any of these other belief systems with another belief system, right?
Yeah, actually, in my book, I say, don't believe a word I'm saying, because a lot of beliefs, whenever you accept a belief, it would be like if you came to me and you're really hungry and you're coming to me for food, and I tell you about this great meal I had last night. Well, it might be intellectually stimulating, but it's not going to nourish you. And that's exactly what a belief is. A belief ends up being a substitute for the truth, and it keeps people from really going out and having the experience for themselves. I know when I interviewed Don Miguel Ruiz, he says, don't believe anybody, don't believe anything, always have doubt, because that's what starts the wheels turning, and you start thinking again. And you go out and have your own experience, then it's yours.
Give me the general premise, just as sort of a framework by which we can operate under for the rest of our conversation.
Sure. Premise of the book?
Yeah.
Okay, yeah, well, what started me thinking about this process is I read a quote by Voltaire. Voltaire said, if they can make you believe in absurdities, they can make you commit atrocities. And I started thinking about that and started talking with neuroscientists like Andrew Newberg, for instance, and come to find out there is a similarity of neural networks between a person that has accepted some belief that is absurd, in other words, out of touch with reality and no experience, no history. It takes a lot of mental juggling to support and maintain that belief. Well, that kind of a person is also easily talked into doing things that they wouldn't normally do. So when we're talking about a belief, what I'm really talking, now don't get this confused with like an intention. This is a different thing. A belief that I'm talking about is like the predisposition we have on this whole planet to pretend like we know things that are in fact unknowable. And a lot of times these are cosmological truths of the universe that are really a mystery. But I think over the past centuries and the early part of our evolution, we've had to make up stories to fill in the gaps because not knowing has been fearful for us. But what's happening now as we're evolving more into a spiritual consciousness, a realm where we're more at ease with saying, I don't know. I think we're coming to grips with the fact that this is truly a mystery. And we can figure out this mystery, but along the way, be comfortable with saying, I don't know.
Isn't that part of the process, though, of figuring things out, whether it's religion or politics or whatever, science even, is that you come up with a theory and it's tested over time and you either keep it or discard it?
Well, this is the difference between science and religion, because science do put their theories, you could call them beliefs, but they're really a theory or a hypothesis, but they put them up for peer review, and they're always in motion, they're always changing. The trouble is, with religion, so many years ago, and remember, the Judeo-Muslim-Christian religions, the roots of that date back to the Iron Age, and I venture to say that we've excelled in science light years from that particular point. But the problem with religion is we've made it into a dogma and written it down in books, and we can't change anything, because if you change anything, you're destroying the belief. But the trouble is, the gap between religion and science is getting so great. I remember Joseph Campbell saying once that his fear about all of this is that as science keeps going into the future and really getting a grip on the reality of the etheric world and the subtler energies, and religion is left so far behind, that we will have this tendency to eventually drop religion altogether, and that means dropping the stories, the mythology, and everything that goes along with it. And that would be a shame, because mythology has always been a really good way, a good vehicle, to relay one truth from generation to generation without losing anything in the translation or the literalness, because mythology is based upon something that's innate within a human psyche and the archetypes.
Well, here's my initial reaction when I absorbed your general premise, and it was this, when you're talking about religion, and I'm not an especially avid religious person myself, but that religion has helped a heck of a lot of people over the centuries. It's helped people during very dark times, and you even note that in your book. You say that religion has burned like a candle flame through dark times in our history, which it has. It's also led a lot of good people, or people who could be not so good, to a good place, and into believing, the golden rule and do unto others and things of that sort. And although different religions can be seen as different paths to the same place, for millions, tens of millions of people, it's ended up being a positive thing.
Yes, and looking back, I can sympathize with a lot of the people that have held on to their religious faith and their beliefs, and it have seen them through some dark times. But that was at a time when we didn't have such a grip on the scientific knowledge that we have today. And a lot of times when you have a certain theory or a belief, it makes sense at the time. There's a funny little story about this guy is sitting in a plane with four engines, and they're flying along, and the captain comes on the intercom and says, the number one engine, it went out, and I'm sorry, but we're going to be up here for another hour. So it was okay. A couple minutes later, he comes back on, and he says, sorry about this, but number two and three engine went out, so we're going to be up here probably another hour. So the guy sitting on the plane says, boy, if that fourth engine goes out, we'll be up here all night. And this is just simple, how something can really make sense at first, but as you extrapolate it out into the future, sometimes it gets so far off course, we have to revamp, step back, take a deep breath, and go, okay, where are we at today? And I think when we do this, especially when we look at where our global society is right now, we don't have time to keep wondering about this. We're looking at the exploitation of our dwindling natural resources, the environmental, financial, and social collapse. And in fact, our whole civilization, including the financial structures, are built on infinite growth. And it depends on infinite growth for its survival. But the trouble is, we live on a finite world with finite resources. So that's the problem that we're running into.
And in the beginning of the book, you talk about the state of the world, and I alluded to a lot of the problems we're facing right now. You would say that at the root of all of them, or at least many of them, is a belief system, is a reliance on a belief system.
Yes, and that belief system could be religious, political. We've mixed God and country. Right now, if you're not for the United States, you don't believe in God. I don't know how that has happened over the years, but it has. But these can be personal beliefs, too, personal beliefs that limit us. Anytime you have a belief, and this is the important thing to really grasp, is because if you have a belief, you're just pretending that you know something. And it gets mixed up in this pile of stuff that we really do call facts. But after a while, we forget that we started out pretending that we knew in the first place. So now we're on the verge of a crisis on this planet, and too many people are simply not thinking. And I think if we just look at our beliefs and realize that we have to rethink our whole situation, our religious premises, our political premise, we're going to see that we're on the verge of creating a whole new civilization on this planet based on a new consciousness. But this new consciousness is being bottlenecked by old thinking.
Let's jump right into the religious stuff, because that's going to be the bulk of the conversation, and it's going to be what the listeners are going to want to pummel you about, I think. And it doesn't necessarily mean just Christian beliefs. Let's start with Islam. You know, we hear in our daily lives many times, Islam is a religion of peace, that it teaches peace. And yet every example we look at seems to confer a different kind of image of Islamicists, Muslims, performing terrible acts of violence and terrorism, and it would seem to directly challenge their fundamental beliefs. Talk about Islam for a minute.
Well, if you look at Islam, and you can actually look at the Christian and the Jewish religion too, because the Bible gets into this also. But if you look at a religion like Islam and just read the Quran, I mean, when you read the Quran and you read something like Muhammad is expected to come back on a horse with wings, what it takes to support believing that. Imagine if you didn't believe in Islam altogether, you've never even heard of this, and someone is trying to convince you that a horse with wings is going to bring back a savior and save you. What it takes to twist your mind to believe that leaves you susceptible to believe things like if you kill a bunch of infidels, you're going to get 72 virgins. And what's sort of strange about that is some of the translations of the Quran would tell you that the word for virgins, as it's used in that particular quote, actually could mean white raisins. And it always brings me to a little bit of a laughter if somebody would actually do that and end up realizing they've done this for 72 raisins. You know?
Yeah, I'm not sure they'd have as many volunteers for those suicide bomb missions if raisins were waiting on the other side.
Yeah, I don't think so. I don't think I would do it for 72 virgins.
I can see a Christian saying, well, gosh, that's crazy, this stuff about a winged horse. There's no guy coming back on a winged horse. There's no such thing as getting 72 virgins or raisins. That's ridiculous. And then you have within Christianity, well, the Mormons, they're goofy. They believe that you're going to get a planet. If you're a really good Mormon, you get a planet and you're God on your own planet. And that's got to be crazy. And then, each of them seems to have beliefs, fundamental rock hard beliefs that the other beliefs systems would not accept and would find ridiculous.
Well, see, the Mormons, Scientology, all of these religions that are newer, the reason we see them as a little bit ridiculous is simply because they are new. But once something's been around for a few thousand years, we tend not to question it. And as things don't make sense, or as it goes against our laws, actually, because if you read the Old Testament, Deuteronomy, Leviticus, it is completely against the law. If somebody from another community comes into my community, I cannot make a slave out of them and pass them on to my offspring. If my son drinks a little too much, I can't take him to the edge of town and stone him to death. If my neighbor would come over here and say, hey, you know, the voice of God just told me to kill my son, I need to borrow a knife, I wouldn't make a profit out of him. I would call 911. And this is just telling you that as a society, in the face of persecution, burning at the stake and everything else, we have grown morally to the point to where we can no longer live by the old laws of the Bible. And I think we just need to look at this and realize that this was written by men, along with the Quran and everything else. It's so patriarchal that it boggles my mind to even think that the creator of the universe would sit down and write a book like this.
What about the idea, you raised the question, what if your child were hit by a drunk driver?
Yeah.
Would you be concerned about the kind of car it was? What's the point in that?
Well, the point is we're all in this together, and we tend to put labels on these different religions, and we're not going down to the fundamental problem. And the fundamental problem is the belief systems that underlie all this. And it really doesn't matter what the belief is, whether it's a Muslim or Jewish or Christian or a Hindu or a Buddhist. At this level, people tend to be sort of drunk with this belief. So if somebody would hit my child, I wouldn't say, "What was that, a Ford or a Chevy or a Muslim?" Or I would want to know the state of mind of that person. And when you look at the state of mind of religious fanatics, religious fundamentals, extremists, they're drunk with this belief. And if you're not talking, now here you have to remember this, for a belief to sustain itself, it has to be believable. So when a belief or a belief system is so far out of touch with reality, with science, with experience, with history, with everything that we know to be real, what it takes to support that belief ends up, well, in the words of Andrew Newberg, Dr. Andrew Newberg is a neuroscientist. He told me it causes brain damage. And I said, "Andrew, don't you have a more appropriate neuroscientific word than that?" He says, "No, it's brain damage." Because what happens is as you make that belief believable, you start cutting yourself off from experience and history and science and everything else. This is actually causing the brain synapses to break. So as those synapses start breaking, remember, if they fire together, they wire together. But if they don't fire, they don't wire. Eventually, your brain goes through an atrophy and starts shrinking. And once that process starts, now you're going to end up with a person that we've always called people like that tunnel vision and narrow-mindedness, myopic, and you almost have to stand right in front of them and use their exact terminology, their exact words for them to hear what you're saying. But if your logic goes and expands beyond what their limiting beliefs can accept, we know now that neurologically they don't even hear what we're talking about. They don't even hear the words sometimes.
You know, I could see you having a problem with specific kinds of miracles that are reported in the Bible, that it's not within your experience, that science would say it's not possible. And you would have, as a result of that, problems with the idea of faith, or specifically blind faith. And you might have problems with, say, the Ten Commandments, where the Bible and biblical scholars prescribe specific kinds of behavior or prohibitions. But what about the idea of just the underlying golden rule, do unto others? Why that would be a bad way to live?
I think that would be a great way to live. And, well, like with the Ten Commandments, the first four commandments have nothing to do with morals or anything else. That's about keeping you within the religion. And some of the commandments, like coveting your neighbor's wife or his ox, or in this case, whatever you would have in today's world, I mean, read in Deuteronomy, if you break any of those commandments, that it's death. So that means if my neighbor comes over and steals my lawnmower, by biblical command, divine sanction, I'm supposed to take his life. And this is what I'm talking about. We cannot live by the literal truth of the Bible anymore.
Okay, Rahasia Poe is my guest. He's the author of To Believe or Not to Believe. We'll jump into more of our discussion of whether religion and science can coexist peacefully, whether there's merit in that proposition, when we come back here on Coast to Coast AM. We're talking with Rahasia Poe about his new book, To Believe or Not to Believe, and I'm sure a lot of you are ready to jump at your radio right now because it's talking about very touchy topics. Can science and religion coexist? Is there such a thing as the power of prayer? Is there what is the difference between spirituality and religion? And how does this work around to our political beliefs? Are they as illusory as our religious beliefs? We'll get into those topics and more, then be opening up the phone lines at the top of the hour. So stay with us here on Coast to Coast AM. Rahasia Poe, is there a point at which science and religion can coexist peacefully, agree on at least some basics?
Well, I think actually they're two sides of the same coin. For me, true religion, I'm talking about real religion, because the word religion is the same word as yoga is. It means union, to pull together, to connect. I think real religion, what it does is it gives us, and I use the word faith here, not faith as it's used so much as a license just to simply believe whatever you want to believe because it doesn't have evidence. But I mean, there is a faith that we have in human nature, and we have to have that moment of faith to step out into the darkness based upon what we've known from the past. And I think this is where religion can come together with science, because religion can push science in a certain kind of a way. And sometimes it's right, sometimes it's wrong, but science can validate that. And we can either continue that path or pull back from that path.
There's an article that we posted on our website tonight, and I did it on purpose in connection with your interview here. It's about scientists speculating on what is beyond the limits of the universe. If, in fact, the universe is finite, what's on the other side? Is that something that you would classify as unknowable and thus in the realm of faith, or is that the kind of question that science could eventually answer?
Well, I think it's the kind of a question that needs to be asked, and then through scientific process, start taking small steps in that direction. My name, Rahasia, means mystery, and it was a name I was given in India, and actually it means something I have to focus on, and I spent so much of my life trying to figure out the mystery, I forgot to live it. And I think life, we forgot to live in this mystery. And science can take us methodically into the future, but the trouble is religion is being left behind, because it's really not religion, it's tradition. We have a tradition that dates back to the Iron Age that has been crystallized, and there's so many of us, I use the word spiritual people, that's actually trying to save religion in its truest sense. And I talk to biblical scholars and people that really know the Bible, and none of them take it literally. Of course, I shouldn't use the word none, but most do not take the literal truth of the Bible. They call it a story. I was talking to a rabbi once. He says, hey, it's just a story. What are you getting so entangled in this? And this is the problem. We get so entangled into the story. And my book, what it's really about, isn't about beliefs in themselves, whether it's Muslims or Christians or Jewish or Buddhist. It's about the cognitive process of believing anything at all. Because one way to look at this is in a dream, like if we're having a dream, the first step to waking up in that dream is to say to yourself, this is a dream. I'm asleep. Now, at that point, you're not awake, but you've caused a crack in the very foundation of that reality. Well, in this reality, the thing that causes the crack in that foundation is to doubt the illusion. But the trouble is, all of our media, almost everything around us, our financial systems, everything is built to support that illusion. And if you question that illusion, you're called a crackpot or a criminal, or there's all kinds of institutions they can put you in to control you and try to reform you and rehabilitate you back into the social ways of your society, which is basically the illusion. And beliefs, when we make up a belief, all of our beliefs are to reinforce that illusion. And the moment you start questioning that belief or any belief, it causes the wheels to start turning again, and you start having thoughts. And these thoughts start waking you up. And I can't even begin to tell you how different the world looks once you start realizing that we all wake up on this planet with almost 7 billion people that are also waking up on the planet, and they all have beliefs, and they're living in an illusion and pretending like they're awake and not really realizing that so many of us are asleep. But we are starting to wake, and this is really becoming a crucial matter in today's world, because with everything that's going on, if we don't raise our consciousness to the level that I'm talking about, we're never going to see the crooked politician or the hypocrisy of organized religions. You know, it's the old story that the emperor has no clothes. We need enough people to start speaking out and other people to have doubts and questioning, and all of a sudden you start seeing the truth, and it's right in front of all of us. It's right here. It's not being hid, but we're hiding from it behind our beliefs.
You mentioned how, you know, the Bible maybe shouldn't be taken literally, and even priests and rabbis don't take it all literally, that they look at more as a story or a parable. I read two articles today that sort of cast light on that. One was about this new suggestion that God had a wife, that there were references in early biblical literature to a female counterpart that were edited out. The second article dealt with who the real authors of the Bible are. And I know there's been a lot of scholarly work done on that, that Mark and Matthew and those guys didn't necessarily write the books of the Bible that have their names attached, that it was other people, the hundreds of years later, that were influenced by the political and religious situations of their times, that they edited stuff in and took things out. It would be hard to figure how any of that could be taken literally as often as it has been changed.
Yeah, and as we look back, it would be interesting to jump on this too, and it's tempting, but actually in the time period that we're talking about where the Bible was being put together and written, it was a pretty popular thing to do to put somebody else's name to it. And a lot of times this was done deceptively, but a lot of times it was just the way things were done at the time. But yeah, now they can recognize that there was only two or three writers for Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, and it was written far after the fact. And I think as far as science and religion goes, Einstein once said that science without religion is lame and religion without science is blind. And it's a perfect example of this balance that we have of left and right hemispheres in our brain. This is why it's so important to save religion, but bring it up to a level to where it should be in the first place. And I think as we do this, we're going to find something really incredible happen within the neurology of our brain, because we're so used to the dichotomy of life, the polarization of everything. We're either Republican or Democrat. We're either this religion or that religion. Everything is either up or down, in or out. And this is because of how our mind has evolved. But something's happening here lately. And when I say lately, probably within the past 200 or 300 years, started actually with the Renaissance, but within the past couple of hundred years, something is starting to bubble up to the surface, and it's requiring us to think in a different way, to sort of walk on that razor's edge. And the people that do this, it's a very precarious place to be, because you have to find balance. And the people on one side either try to pull you down to their side or push you over to the other, not realizing that you're trying to talk about a new level of consciousness that so far only a few people are noticing, except people like Jesus and Buddha. I think they all experienced this, but the key word here is experience. And the fortunate people to be around them at the time were resonating with that. But as time goes on, it gets dwindled down and it loses its fire, and it becomes a belief, and it becomes a dogma that's just passed on to generation after generation.
Belief and dogma, a blind faith. What do you say to people for whom there is evidence? For example, the power of prayer. I think there's been even some scientific books written on the power of prayer. And I know that there are people in our audience who would say that in their life, that prayer has made a difference, that there have been tangible results, that in their view, it does constitute evidence. I guess the question would be evidence of what?
Well, I think that's an extreme sign of the fact that we live in a non-local space. We live very entangled in random event generators. I was talking to Lynn McTaggart about this. They have about 70 random event generators all over the planet, and it clearly shows that the global consciousness, the collective consciousness of this planet, is deeply entangled with world events. So when we say a prayer, I mean, it's one person saying a prayer, but imagine if we could say a prayer on a collective level. But to do that, we all need to be on the same page, and as long as we have divisive beliefs, we're never going to be on the same page. I remember something that the Dalai Lama said, because in the 10 questions to the Dalai Lama, one of the things that didn't end up in that documentary was he was asked, what could we do about the conflict in the Middle East? And he stopped and he thought for a second. He said, well, I think we could invite them to a picnic and just don't let them talk. Because the moment they start talking about their beliefs, and they're so identified with these divisive beliefs that we can't get them on the same page. This is why it's important that we all go past our beliefs. And the only way to do that is to dismantle our beliefs one belief at a time. I remember talking to Amit Goswami. I asked him about the beliefs. He says, how do you get out of a belief system? First, you have to deconstruct the belief system. Traditionally, the teacher is supposed to remove your ignorance. But when you remove ignorance, you start with removing what is causing the ignorance, which is your belief system. So the teacher's job, indeed, is to first deconstruct your belief system and then to give you inspiration so you'll go out and create a path to discover what is spirit, what is beauty, what is love, because these things nobody can teach you. So teaching really should be a demolition job. But unfortunately, what our spiritual teachers have been giving us are beliefs, when indeed they should be breaking those beliefs down. And this is what divides us, and this is what's been causing so many of our wars. And if you look back in time, I mean, the medieval Inquisition, the Portuguese Inquisition, the Roman Inquisition, the Spanish, all of these things are based upon people's beliefs. And again, now we're going to get into this a little bit here, but it's important to understand that what we used to do, like in the Inquisitions and even in mobs, lynch mobs, we tend to hide out in mobs and do things collectively that we would never think of doing individually. Like someone was once telling me that the death penalty is a good thing and they're all for it. And I said, well, are you willing to go there and pull the lever? Well, no. Okay, then you're not really for the death penalty. You're trying to hide in a mob or a group. But the trouble is, we don't have mobs anymore. We have corporations. We have nations. And we hide in these corporations and nations and religions and send them out to do things that we normally wouldn't do. I don't know one person in my life that would go to Iraq and, if there was no war there, go there and shoot Muslims. I don't know anybody. But yet, as a nation, we can enlist whole armies full of people to go over there and do this. And we support them in all of our ways by voting and by spending and the military budget and all of this. And I think we forget that 160 million other human beings have been killed by human beings in the last century alone. And this is something to really consider when we stop and look to see who is really paying for this. And it's so many women and children. I remember reading statistics. In World War I, 80% of the people was innocent bystanders and collateral damage, as they call it, for lack of a better term. But World War II, it was up to about 40%. Vietnam was 60%. Well, now we're up to 90% of the people that we're killing aren't even involved in the war. So we're not even killing the people that we're supposed to be killing if we were supposed to kill anybody at all.
Well, it's hard to make that distinction when people that you're out there to kill are not wearing a uniform, somebody like the Taliban or the Al-Qaeda or something like that, I guess. But I get the point you're making, because it's been made before, is that in the name of religion, we've done abominable things. I mean, and are still doing it. Religion and religious beliefs have been used to justify not only wars, but slavery, the subjugation of women, and as you point out in your book, rape.
Right. You know, oftentimes women are used as reward systems for soldiers that are conquering. It's also a form of genocide, too. You can go in and wipe out the bloodline of a culture by wiping them out and impregnating the women.
You make a distinction, though, between spirituality and religion. Religion being what's represented by churches, spirituality being the kind of contact that we each as individuals can have with God or whatever name you want to call it.
Right. In my book, I have a long list of what is spiritual and what is religious. And until we can blend those two columns together, I think we're always going to be divided on what we need to do. And all of this is leading up to being able to see the world as it is and start handling and processing our problems and our situations differently.
Well, we'll get to that in a second. Before we leave this idea of spirituality and religion, give me some of the things that are on that list. How can you tell the difference?
Well, everything that's religious usually has a limited way of looking at it. Like God, for instance, is a being that's really limited in his scope. Like myself, I believe in some type of consciousness that permeates reality. Underneath the manifested matter of reality, there does seem to be a conscious intent. And this conscious intent has been happening since the very first moments of creation. I mean, at the first moment of creation, there was a quantum soup of atomic particles. Real quick-like, they formed into small components called atoms. Those atoms formed into small components called molecules. The molecules formed into cells, and the cells into organisms. There seems to be a self-organizing intent to this consciousness. And this simply means that right now, if this process is still in effect, which I would assume it is, I fail to even imagine that we are the epitome of what creation can come up with. At this point, that means that we as human beings are planetary cells coming together to form a planetary consciousness.
I mean, what's your
many people have talked about this. Pierre Desjardins, I know he talked about it as the new sphere. And he was a Jesuit priest, and he was one of the many, many visionaries that started to see this coming. More recently, Peter Russell, and a few years ago, Lewis Thomas wrote a book called The Lives of Cells. There seems to be a consciousness that is pulling things together, and the only thing that changes this now, because you have to think, up to this point, evolution, whatever evolution is, has happened pretty much as an automatic response, completely separate from our interaction. But what has happened now is, since we are starting to become more involved and entangled into the evolution, we're becoming conscious participants in it.
Well, I definitely want to get into that, into the practicality and applicability of consciousness and how we can change the world around us. My guest is Rahasia Poe. The book is called To Believe or Not to Believe. We'll be opening up the phone lines in just a couple of minutes, so stay with us here on Coast to Coast AM.